This is Movies for the Blind, episode 156, Blackmail, part 1 of 3.
I always think a girl knows instinctively when she can trust a man.
Yes, of course she does.
Hello and welcome to Movies for the Blind, where you can enjoy films without looking at a screen. I'm Valerie Hunter. Well, I said I was going to bring you some Hitchcock, and I'm going to go as far back as I can while still having audible dialogue in the film. Alfred Hitchcock was already a fairly successful director of silent films in England, and he was working on another one when word came down from the movie studio that they wanted to try some brand new technology allowing for talking pictures. Would Hitchcock reshoot some of the film to make it a talkie? Being the experimental guy he was, of course he would. It became one of the first British sound pictures ever. But that doesn't mean he redid everything. The first 8 or so minutes of the film, aside from music and some new sound effects, would remain without dialogue. So hang in there, because I got a lot of work to do right off the bat. From 1929, in 3 parts, this is Blackmail. British International Pictures Limited presents Blackmail, from the play by Charles Bennett. Directed and adapted by Alfred Hitchcock. Dialogue by Ben Levy. Photography by Jack Cox. Art director W.C. Arnold. Assistant director Frank Mills. Film editor Emile de Ruelle. Musical score by Campbell and Connolly. Compiled and arranged by Hubert Bath and Harry Stafford. British International Symphony Orchestra. Conductor John Reinders. Recorded by the RCA Photophone System. A British International Picture. Made and recorded at Elstree, London. Distributed by Warder Films Limited. Cast: Alice White, Aniandra. Mrs. White, Sarah Allgood. Mr. White, Charles Payton. Detective Frank Weber, John Longdon. Tracy, Donald Calthrop. The artist, Cyril Richard. The landlady, Hannah Jones. The chief inspector, Harvey Braben. The detective sergeant, ex-detective Serge Bishop. A wheel spins. It's on a covered truck, speeding through London. Under a tarpaulin in the bed of the truck, a man wearing headphones transcribes a message on official Metropolitan Police notepaper. Flying Squad Van 68. Proceed at once to 6 Cambria. He passes it to 2 detectives, one of whom stands, hunched over, and directs the driver. He makes a fast turn in the other direction. The detective sits again as the truck rushes on. When it stops, both detectives jump out, joined by another who was riding with the driver, and they walk quickly under a large archway, past a horse-drawn cart and a few children playing. The older detective leads the 2 younger ones to a smaller archway, where more children chase each other. Watched by some of the denizens of the working-class area, the detectives walk through the archway, where the children run under lines of plain laundry hung out to dry. They walk on, followed by the resident men, to a building's doorway, where they're met by an older woman protesting desperately. The older detective steps past her as a younger one guides her aside, then goes in while the other detective keeps her at bay. The 2 detectives go up a flight of stairs in the old spare building, then turn to look ahead and move on another few steps. The elder man leads the younger to a door at the end of a hall. When instructed, the younger man steps to the right to block the way as the elder slowly opens the door. They look in soberly at someone sitting up in a bed smoking from behind an open newspaper. The thin, balding man glances over his paper, across the room, to a small mirror where he sees the detective's reflection. He considers, with ash falling from his cigarette, and looks down to the right to a nightstand, where a pistol sits. the detectives watch. As the man's right hand slowly slides down the newspaper, the elder puts an arm in front of the younger. And when the man reaches for the gun, the elder lunges and struggles for it. The man throws it aside. With his cigarette still in his mouth, he talks with the elder detective, who waves him off. The man protests when the younger man takes a book from the nightstand, but he keeps it, along with a pocket watch. The man appears confused with what the elder detective asks, but he soon grins and acquiesces. Folding the paper, he sets it aside, then looks on either side of the bed. The elder detective hands him socks, and the younger offers trousers, but the man waves them off and keeps looking. In his nightshirt, he swings his legs over the side of the bed away from the detectives. The man starts getting dressed. The younger detective steps to a window in front of him and dodges when something small flies through the glass. The man removes his cigarette to grin. Soon after, he is escorted to the back of the truck. Taking a bite of an apple, he climbs inside, and the detectives follow as a crowd watches. The truck pulls away. Later, an officer paces outside the front entrance of a building, which the truck passes. Another officer waits in a doorway, where the truck stops. The tailgate drops, and the younger detective climbs down, followed by the suspect with the elder. They step past the officer into the building. New Scotland Yard. The three men walk down a long hall toward a pair of glass doors. Soon after, the detectives stand while the suspect sits, being questioned by an inspector behind a desk. Another man enters the room with a tea tray, steps around the inspector, and sets the tray on the desk. He asks the inspector about sugar, then the suspect, who asks for two spoonfuls. The elder detective offers the suspect a cigarette, which he accepts, and has lit for him. As tea is poured, the cigarette rests on an ashtray. By the time five butts are there with another cigarette burning, the inspector speaks more forcefully with the suspect, who's turned away, fidgeting. He waves off the inspector's accusations. Later, near where rules are posted for identification parades, a woman walks along a row of men, watched by the detectives and an officer. She pauses at one, looks back at the officer, and places her hand on the suspect. Later, a sign on a door reads, "Charge Room." A sergeant steps through it, followed by another officer, the detectives, and the suspect. The other officer blows his nose while the sergeant steps behind a podium with a document. The sergeant asks the suspect a question, which he answers with a sneer, and the sergeant snaps back. The suspect takes off the hat he was wearing in the parade, and the sergeant starts writing on a charge sheet. The suspect scowls down. Later, fingerprints are taken. A man places the suspect's inked index finger on a card, then puts another finger on the ink pad, watched by the younger detective. Later, a door marked cells is opened by an officer. The suspect struggles with the elder detective. He's shoved into a cell, which the officer closes. Both detectives walk away.
Well, we finished earlier tonight than I expected.
Yes.
You going anywhere?
I think so.
Soon after, in a hallway.
The next time, I changed to another tailor. I found out that he was no better than the first. I bought some pretty expensive cloth and took it to him. You should have seen the mess he made of it. I told him I wouldn't pay for the thing. But the trouble is, he's got fine material.
They walk around a corner.
Well, I left the suit with him, and it's been there ever since.
They enter a locker room, where other detectives wash in sinks and smoke. The elder detective washes up. The younger does as well. Another chats with a colleague holding a pair of handcuffs in a small box. The elder and younger detectives dry their hands with towels. The younger wipes his face, and they both walk off. Retrieving their coats, they leave the locker room, walk down a hall, and turn down another. Stepping through glass doors, they meet a young blonde woman.
Good evening, Miss White. How are you?
I'm all right, thanks.
I haven't seen you for a long time.
The younger detective kisses her cheek.
Have you come to take Frank for a walk?
Yes.
That's right. Well, I must push along. Good night.
Good night.
Good night, Frank.
The elder detective leaves.
Well, dear?
I've been waiting here half an hour for you.
She turns away, pouting, as he holds her arm. She steps away from his grasp to an officer, who whispers in her ear. They all laugh.
Good night, George.
Good night, Frank.
The couple leaves through the front entrance. Alice catches herself and pouts again. Then they descend steps to the sidewalk. Frank tries to take her arm again, but she resists, so he holds on to her elbow. She keeps her face turned away as they pass another officer.
Night, George.
She has a harder time looking mad as they walk past a line of officers. They stop at a corner. Later, as they ride a train on the underground, a boy beside Frank pulls down the hat of a stocky man behind them, who complains to the women with the boy. As the women chat with each other, the boy again climbs on the bench Frank sits on and stares down at the man, who stares back. Later, Alice and Frank step through slow car traffic to cross the street and enter a very large, very busy restaurant. They join a line to get into an elevator. But it fills before they can board it, so they speak to each other and a nearby attendant. Alice and Frank go up a wide open staircase. Stepping to doors to that level's dining room, they're stopped by a boy attendant.
Sorry, sir. Come up here. More room upstairs.
Go on.
I think I told you there's more room upstairs.
When the boy turns away...
Sorry, sir. Come up here. More room up...
They go in.
Hey!
They make their way to the middle of the large, crowded room and look around. Frank takes off his hat.
Hello, Frank.
They search in different directions for a place to sit. As waitresses bustle about taking orders and carrying trays, Frank escorts Alice through the room to where a party looks to be vacating their table and hover near it with another couple. When the party leaves, Alice gets a seat, but so does the man from the other couple. Their counterparts each pull them away, and Frank rushes Alice to another open table where they sit. Smiling, Frank opens the menu, but Alice looks around for something.
Frank, I've lost one of my gloves. I think I left it at the other table.
Chagrined, Frank gets up and goes to the other table. He returns with a glove.
Is this it?
Yes, thanks.
Thought so. There's a hole in two fingers. Would you like a pair of nail scissors for Christmas?
Funny, aren't you?
Miss!
It's no good being impatient. You'll have to wait your turn.
What's the matter with you today? Got out of bed the wrong side?
I don't like waiting about for you.
Oh, don't you? Miss!
He fails again to get the attention of a waitress.
Do you expect the entire machinery of Scotland Yard to be held up to please you?
You and your Scotland Yard. If it weren't for Edgar Wallace, nobody'd ever heard of it.
Funny, aren't you? Anyway, what's the hurry? We're only going to the pictures, and we've got all evening.
He takes out a cigarette.
Well, I don't think I want to go to the pictures.
Oh, and why not?
I've seen everything worth seeing.
You haven't seen fingerprints. I'd like you to see that. Still, it's about Scotland Yard. It might be amusing. They're bound to get all the details wrong.
I don't see why. I did hear they'd got a real criminal to direct it, so as to be on the safe side.
Oh, miss! Miss!
Oh, blast.
When he leaves the table to retrieve a waitress, Alice opens her purse and takes out a note. I'll be here on Tuesday at 6:30. Will you? She puts it back in her purse and notes her watch reads 6:58. She looks around the room, then taps on the table, agitated. Frank returns and sits.
Well, I've ordered.
I'll go to the pictures with you if you like.
Changed your mind.
A waitress arrives to serve tea. As Frank speaks to her, Alice brightens when she sees another man smiling at her.
Straight where I sit.
Their smiles fade as they consider their situation. The man nods and raises an eyebrow as he turns away. Then sits at a nearby table. Alice returns her attention to Frank, who smokes.
Frank, I've changed my mind again.
The waitress leaves.
What about?
About going to the pictures.
You mean you don't want to go again?
No, not particularly.
And why not?
I don't know. I just don't want to. Isn't that enough?
No, it's not enough.
He butts out.
Hi, miss!
What are you going to do?
I'm going to get the bill. I'm about fed up with you.
He reaches into his coat pocket.
If you don't want to go, I do.
Oh, all right. I'll come too.
Hi, miss!
He waits for the waitress.
Oh, don't let's have a row. I'm sorry. I know I've been rather beastly today.
Miss!
Frank, I've said I'm sorry.
He checks the change in his hand
here.
And sets it down.
That'll cover it.
Grabbing his hat, he gets up and stalks away past the other man, who watches him go and glances at Alice. Frank stalks past the boy out of the room and paces. Pausing, he turns and looks back through the doors and paces some more. Then leans against a wall, thinking. He smirks. He turns to the doors to find Alice stepping out with the other man. He stares as they smile and walk off together. Later, a small man in a dark suit also paces beside a streetlight outside an apartment building. He pauses, looking at the closed door of the front entrance. When he spots someone coming, he steps away. The other man approaches with Alice.
Hold on.
They stop.
I live here.
She turns to the building.
Do you? Then you needn't come any further.
Oh, Lorna, I said I'd see you home, and I will.
But I'm only just round the corner. Do you know White's, the news agent?
Yes.
In the King's Road?
Yes.
That's my father.
No.
The small man watches them.
Well, isn't that fine? Then we're neighbors. Have you ever seen an artist's studio?
No. I'd love to.
Come up and see mine.
Oh, I can't now. Another time.
Why not now?
Well, so late.
Are you frightened?
No, of course not.
Then why not now?
No, really. Thanks awfully. I must be getting home.
You are frightened?
I'm certainly not. Take more than a man to frighten me.
Yeah, that's what I thought. At first.
What is the time?
Not very late. Come on. What's the harm?
Oh, there's no harm, really. Besides, I always think a girl knows instinctively when she can trust a man.
Yes, of course she does. Do you trust me, Alice? May I call you Alice?
If you like.
Come on.
He escorts her to the entrance.
Oh, Mr. Crewe, before you go in, could I...
Excuse me, Alice.
Crewe steps away.
No.
He returns.
The chap's nothing but a sponger.
He unlocks the door.
Always pestering people up and down this street.
Opening the door, he leads her inside.
Well, here we are.
He closes the door.
I'm right up there, top.
They look up a stairwell.
Excuse me a minute, will you?
Setting down his hat, coat, and cane, he picks up some mail from a table and goes through it. He smiles sheepishly at Alice. Then keeps an envelope and a note, which he reads.
I'm awfully sorry. I won't be a minute. You start walking up.
That's all right.
He gets his things. And as Alice takes the first few steps, he walks past her to a door under the stairs and rings a bell. He studies the note as he waits. An older woman answers.
Oh, good evening. Sorry to disturb you. About this note, did he leave any message?
No, he wouldn't leave any message.
Have you seen him before?
Yes, the same gent would call you several times.
I see. Thanks very much. Good night.
Stepping away, he returns to Alice, still waiting on the stairs. And they go up together. They turn and go up another flight. They turn again and go up another flight. Then another. Then a few more steps to a door with shadows of balusters in the nearby wall.
Bit of a climb, wasn't it?
Opening the door, he turns on a light and lets Alice enter ahead of him, smiling in wonder.
What a lovely room.
It's a studio with high ceilings.
Did you do it all yourself?
Hardly. I say, do you feel cold? I think I'll light the fire.
Closing the curtains to a bed, he walks to the door and closes it, then heads for a fireplace as Alice steps to a window. She glances toward him, growing uncertain, and looks out the window down to the sidewalk, where an officer patrols by the streetlight. Reassured, she turns to a painting of a jester pointing at her and smiles. She turns to Crewe across the room.
I say.
And points.
That's good, isn't it?
Who that? Yes, that's a new one, just finished.
Oh.
She wanders through the studio as he whistles. She approaches a china cabinet, a room divider with a ballerina's tutu hanging from one corner, and a grand piano, which she plays with. She turns to a blank canvas on an easel and glances down. Setting down her purse and gloves, she picks up a palette and puts two fingers through the hole in the center.
How'd you hold this?
What?
He turns from pouring drinks.
Oh.
Then wipes his hands with a handkerchief.
That's easy. I'll show you.
He steps over to her as she turns the palette around her fingers.
Oh, Lord, not like that. Let me show you.
He takes it.
You take this, hold it like that, you see?
He holds it steady
then
and picks up a brush.
You get the brush. Hold it there. You try.
She tries to hold it as he did, with his thumb in the hole and fingers where it curves inward. then pretends to pick up paint with the brush and daubs the canvas.
Like this?
Yes.
She's left a mark.
Oh. Look what I've done.
Oh. Yes. Draw something, Alice.
Shall I?
Yes.
She dips the brush in a jar of clear liquid, then straightens up, but stumbles.
Oh. Oh.
He guides her to the canvas, where she paints two more dots over the first mark, a couple lines in between, and a half circle below them. Then she fills in a thick line on top for the hair of her face.
Oh.
She makes the hair dark and shaggy. She turns to Crewe, smiling.
Rotten. Never mind. We'll finish this masterpiece together.
He helps her clean the brush again.
Yeah, yeah. Now you hold the brush. I'll hold your hand. Steady. On your neck.
Holding her hand, he helps her paint lines down from the head, forming a left side.
Down by the leg. Foot.
They paint a foot.
Long, yeah.
Then paint down again.
Knee. Right.
They form a right side.
There we are.
And another bent leg.
Again, bent the ankle.
They paint a shoulder and arm.
Now, there. There.
And form a female chest.
There.
Oh, you are awful.
She cleans the brush on her own.
Wait a minute.
Then she writes words with the brush, signing the painting.
There.
Hooray! All ready for the academy. I'll go and get those drinks.
Right you are.
She sets aside the palette, then the brush, as he walks off. Wandering to the cabinet, she gazes at the china inside. Then she turns to the tutu. She fluffs up the crinolines of the skirt, and it falls into her hands. Before hanging it back up, she holds it up to herself and smiles.
I say, how would I do for one of your models?
He pauses with the drinks.
That's an idea.
Smiling, he approaches her.
Let's see it on you.
Do you mean put it on?
Yes. Why not?
She takes a drink and sips.
Oh, it's so strong.
Then puts it aside.
Go on.
She thinks, and lowers it.
Oh, no, I don't think so. Besides, I'll have to go home soon.
I see it.
He turns to the piano, where he sets down his drink and sits on the bench.
That's it. I'd like to have sketched you in it.
Her eyes go wide as he starts playing. She turns to him.
Would you have really?
Yes. Perhaps you're right. It wouldn't suit you.
I bet it would. Shall I really try it on?
Yes.
He stands.
Will you?
All right.
Good.
She goes behind the divider as he steps away with his drink. So, is this date just getting good, or will things be going downhill pretty quickly? Well, it's Hitchcock. What do you think? Alice may have thrown Frank over, but she'll be needing his help pretty soon. Why? And will she get it? Find out in part two of Blackmail, next time on Movies for the Blind. The hardest part about switching this film from silent to talkie has to do with its star, Annie Andra, who plays Alice. Now, she was a Czech with a heavy accent that would not have worked for her character. There was no time to train her into an English accent, and dubbing in post-production hadn't been invented yet. So, what to do? English actress Joan Barry was brought in to literally speak for Alice off-camera, while Andra lip-synced on-camera. All live. An acting challenge like no other for both actresses. For more information and links about the movies, about description, and how to subscribe, go to the blog, moviesfortheblind.com, where you can also find out about this podcast's Creative Commons license. Also, check out the Movies for the Blind page on Facebook with previews and exclusive video clips. The MP3s are hosted by Blind File Sharing, with easy, affordable, and accessible file storage and transfer with visually impaired users in mind. To find out more, visit blindfilesharing.com. And the movies are from the Internet Archive, so please support universal access to human knowledge by visiting and donating at www.archive.org. Thank you for downloading and for listening. Be back next week. Take care.